Persons listening to this show should experience varying degrees of euphoria and might radiate a warm glow of truth from their entire being. This phenomenon sometimes lasts hours after a typical brain massage. If you are listening with another lights-on listener and they begin to glow, don't be concerned. This is a phenomenon normally associated with Pastor Scheidbach's patented brain massage technique and merely means the truth has set them free. Praise the Lord and pass the ammunition. The Brain Massage Show is ready to go. Get ready. Your brain is about to get a massage.
Hello, I'm Jerry Scheidbach, brain masseur. Get ready for your brain massage.
Truth served here, flavored by delectable wit, delicious sarcasm, succulent sagacity, a gourmet meal for the mind.
Our hats are off to all our World War II vets as we remember D-Day, June 6, 1944. And I still pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. I do not pledge allegiance to Obamistan. I coined that expression and have used it on my show and in various speaking engagements, but as yet I have not laid down a formal definition of the term Obamistan. Obama, well, you know who that is, the president alleged of the United States, the usurper president, who used the IRS to intimidate anti-Obama voters and to harass Tea Party activists, keeping them on their heels so they could not gain momentum in the last election, you know. Yeah, that's what I believe is going on here. And the liar-in-chief who lied about Benghazi, no question about that, and continues to lie about his involvement in the IRS scandal, I believe, who ran against George W. Bush when he wasn't even going on the ticket, who blames George for all his own failures, who accused Bush of compromising our constitutionally protected rights via the Patriot Act, but subsequent to his election has taken those policies way past anything Bush ever contemplated and has created a network of spying that would be the envy of Hitler. And need I continue? That's the Obama I'm talking about. Now, what about the Stan? The expression is Persian, and it means place of, as in Afghanistan, place of the Afghans, and so on. The Stans. It's something of a euphemism used to identify the dangerous, oppressive Islamo-fascist regimes located in the Middle Asia, actually, whose names end with Stan, such as Afghanistan, Pakistan, two of the most well-known, and Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Turkmenistan. And there might be another one out there somewhere I can't think of. In Bible times, this area of the world was peopled by somebody called the Scythians, from the Greek Scuthes, and they were considered savage. And I think that they're much more civilized now, of course. As a matter of fact, I mean, in any event. Anyway, Russia incorporated five of the Stans into the Russian Empire and, basically made it a communist dictatorship. They were never able to dominate Afghanistan or Pakistan, so far as I know, although I know they tried. After the Soviet Empire broke up, all the Stans under their power broke off and developed into moderate Islamic regimes. And these are known to be more westernized than their Islamic brothers. They are interested in becoming more and more independent of Russia, but resistant to democratization. They are moderate in their application of Sharia. In fact, I think most of these Stans don't subscribe their laws under Sharia, even though many of their laws are reflective of their culture, which is heavily influenced by Islam. Nevertheless, in most of the Stans, Christians and Muslims do live together in peace. From Obama's mindset, it's a perfect blend of Islamic cultural domination with limited Sharia influence over the law. Think about it. Where Christians and Muslims can live together in relative peace so long as the Christians behave and don't proselytize, which means they don't share their faith with anyone. You know, where the people desire democracy, as a rule, but they live under rulers who resist democratization, instead preferring a sleeker, more efficient style of government, allowing them a kind of top-down control governing system, unencumbered, you know, with congressional oversight committees and pesky requirement to go through Congress to get laws passed, you know, stuff like that, you know, where too much freedom gets in the way of getting things done. Anyway, it's very close to what Obama wants here. The leadership style and the pattern of governance Obama has established or indicated that he wants for himself here are similar in many ways to the Stans. And so the transformation he wants is from America to Obamistan. Obamistan. That's what America will become if we follow Obama's vision for America. Of course, a more mature Stan, I mean, you know, one that is at least friendlier to the LGBT crowd, that are going to get preferential treatment, by the way, in Obamacare, you see, to make up, by the way, for all the victimization. That would certainly be one thing that will distinguish Obama's stand from the other stands, but a Soviet-style government with Islamic cultural domination, with Christians subservient to that cultural domination, Christians kind of held in check and on a leash, with rulers free to exercise virtual dictatorship over the people, Obama's dream for America, Obamistan. Let's talk a little bit about the politics of revenge. There are many ways to generally characterize any political system. For example, many on the left characterize capitalism as, the politics of greed. Most of us would characterize it as the politics of freedom. Capitalism cannot survive, much less thrive, in a totalitarian political environment, whereas greed shows itself in every political environment, especially when liberals are in control. Or so it would seem, IRS spending $40 to $50 million on conferences over the last 2 years. And that's only the most recent outrageous scandal of government excess and waste to surface. About a while back, we had another big blow-up in that area. Obama's excessive use of taxpayer dollars for his ridiculous number of vacations. Michelle's extravagant in-your-face lifestyle on the taxpayer's dime. I mean, so much of it is. To name a few examples. So the point is, greed knows no political affiliation. It knows no ethnic identification. The fact remains that, however, freedom is connected to capitalism, and slavery is connected to communism. You cannot separate freedom from capitalism, and you cannot separate slavery from communism, and every effort to do so results in a conversion of the system to the other. Separate slavery from communism, and it creeps into capitalism. Separate freedom from capitalism, and it creeps into communism. Some would characterize communism as the politics of sharing. That's sweet, right? We would characterize it as the politics of oppression. But the idea, the point is that to focus on the primary motivating impulse or force driving the system. And Obama's politics can be characterized in many ways. But one of the primary characteristics or impulses motivating Obamatics is revenge. Let's talk about the politics of revenge. Dinesh did a good job rooting out Obama's roots. You've heard me speak to his Kenyan heritage also, his connection to the Mau Mau Rebellion via his grandfather, his ancestral hatred for Britain and especially Churchill, and everything white, really, for ordering the suppression of that rebellion in what was then an English colony. You are also familiar with Obama's affection for anti-America icons, such as domestic terrorists Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn, his affinity with their political philosophy, and the political philosophy of counter-revolutionary Saul Alinsky, political grandfather to all of these. In fact, Obama patterns his political life according to the Alinsky model. I mean, he plays by the Alinsky playbook. A bit more about Alinsky then. Saul Alinsky was, you remember, a communist who felt the communists weren't communist enough. He liked guys like Lenin and Stalin, who were just, you know, men who were totally void of conscience, cold, brutal, willing to do whatever was necessary to achieve the utopia they promised the people. And to get that, to put that utopia in place, it was necessary to have the power to force it on the people. Yeah, Lenin was one of Alinsky's favorite communists, and he was impatient with these passive communists. Yeah, he wouldn't have any use for that. He felt they were too restrained by their dogma, too committed to the ideological objective. In other words, Alinsky, by the way, who was a deracinated Jew. That means to uproot or to separate oneself from his race, the way I'm using it here anyway. Essentially, Alinsky felt an antipathy toward his genetic connection to the Jewish people in a way similar to how Obama feels an antipathy, let's just say it, toward his genetic connection to whites. Alinsky, a deracinated Jew, would never join the Communist Party because, in his own words, he was too radical for that party. Too radical to be shackled and constrained within a party system. He was an independent operator man, an independent communist. He believed Marxist principles, all right. He admired the communist ideology. Would never speak against communist Russia. Oh no. But he would sure speak against America. But he believed the only way to succeed at advancing communist objectives was to hide the objective and act as a free radical. Yeah, double entendre intended. Uncommitted, that's the cancer in our country. Uncommitted to a particular group, unrestrained by any ideological compunction about right and wrong, stuff like that. You know, for example, he criticized the communists for stating their objectives out front. He believed if people understood the objective that motivated his criticism of the establishment, if it was an objective that threatened the interests of the people, well, then that they would object to the criticism, see, and reject him as an operative. However, he believed if they were kept in the dark about his objectives, well, then he could keep them focused on his criticisms of the establishment and be heard and received and accepted and be able to motivate the people to rise up against the establishment and overturn it without them ever even knowing they were being duped and used to tear down the apparatus of their own liberty. Alinsky wanted America to be communist. He wanted America to be transformed. Same language and same objectives as Obama. Marxism is the goal of Obama, and he's using the Alinsky playbook to accomplish those goals. Alinsky was dedicated to Satan, by the way, as the first rebel who, according to Alinsky's dedication for his book, or of his book, Rules for Radicals, he, by the way, in that dedication, he said concerning Satan, he was the first rebel, and so he dedicated his book to him. And that Satan, in his rebellion, earned for himself a kingdom. Of course, he didn't stop to think that was the kingdom of hell, did he? Essentially, Alinsky was a disciple of Lucifer. He really was. He trained people like Hillary, by the way. For example, Hillary's thesis at Wellesley in 1969 was a tribute to Alinsky. Alinsky also shaped Obama as a community organizer. Indeed, you know what? Obama taught Alinsky's principles for radicals for several years. That's right. Obama taught workshops on the Alinsky method for several years as a community organizer. And by the way, I think it was Alinsky who invented that title, that occupation, if you will, the idea of community organizer. I think that was hatched in his mind. It's how he described himself anyway. To understand Alinsky is to understand Obama. But one thing about Alinsky, if you seem to perceive, is this. His whole thing was about revenge. He was an angry man, and he sought revenge. His method of organizing was to find someone or some group that saw themselves as being held down by others, victimized by others, who envied the surplus others enjoyed, who felt inferior economically, socially, or personally, or politically in any way, or racially, you name it. If he could identify a group that had some sense of inferiority toward others for whatever reason, he would exploit that, exacerbate it, justify their resentment, give them a target to focus their hatred, and then give them a path to get revenge. It was always about getting revenge on the uppity class or on the other. Obama's politics are all about tapping into a group that perceives themselves or itself to be a victim of society, siding with them, helping them focus their resentment toward a specific group currently in power, and then motivating these victims to take revenge on them by giving power to him. And by playing up the idea that they're oppressed or held down, it's all fabrication in their mind, he then justifies them on a spiritual level to go at it in a self-righteous sort of way. It's unbelievable. They use economic disparity, racial differences, even religious differences, anything that will provide an opportunity to suggest one group is unfairly taking advantage of another, and then showing that group that how they can get revenge on the offenders by giving him power. And that's what he's done on a kind of subliminal level. That's the motivation that's tying most people, or many of these people, to Obama. This defines Obama's personality, my friend. He's all about revenge. I mean, on a personal level, he is about getting revenge on the white man. That, in his imagination, oppressed his grandfather. Revenge on the white slave owners from the colonial to the Civil War epoch. Even though that's all past history. And no white person I know in America ever held slaves or would hold slaves. And only a very small handful of Americans ever really did. And or are related to anyone who ever did. It's just about revenge. Motivating revenge. Crumb, I just got to the point here. But I do need to take a break. Consider, Obama is about getting revenge against the rich on behalf of the poor, about getting revenge against the whites for past abuses on the blacks. He's about getting revenge for the Hispanics, revenge for the Muslims, revenge, revenge, revenge. Obamatics is the politics of revenge. I'll be right back.
Every corruption we see in our houses of government begin in our houses of worship. Christians begin departing from the founders of our faith and ignoring God's laws long before our politicians begin departing from our founders and ignoring the laws of our land. Revival must begin in the house of God with a return to the old paths. Lighthouse Baptist Church invites you to join us on the old path. Call 347-9887 or go to santamarialighthouse.org for more information. Churches have led our nation toward the ruin we face, and it's up to the churches to lead us back from destruction. God calls his people back to the old paths. Lighthouse Baptist Church is inviting God's people to join us on the old path. Call 347-9887 or go to SantaMariaLighthouse.org for more information. Stand by. Five, the Brain four, Massage Show three, is about to blow your mind.
Hello, I'm Jerry Scheibach, Brain Masseur, and Paul Revere's Lantern Lighter, lighting the lamps of the Church of Every Art, singling the enemies on the march, an enemy that would steal from us our liberties. In the last segment, I discussed the concept of the politics of revenge. You see it acted out daily before your eyes by these men, Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, Jeremiah Wright, Obama's former pastor, virtually all of the gay rights community, the atheists likewise. Revenge. You look at it carefully. It's revenge. A revenge against Christians for, well, for living out their faith in public in front of them. It's unbelievable. Obama is more clever. He hides this a little bit better, but these people are very open about the fact that they intend to exact revenge on white, straight, religious Americans. You understand, of course, that Obama and his ilk, Susan Rice, and to a lesser extent Hillary and the rest, are users. They capitalize, interesting word, on this revenge motivation and politicize it. They do this in order to gain power. They justify their lust and greed for power, power and more power, by convincing themselves that it, in the end, it's intended to change the world as it is into the world as it ought to be. Imagine the hubris of this fellow, this megalomaniac, to assume he is the one to define how the world ought to be. Unbelievable. It's the utopian pipe dream revisited. The idea that man can create a world without disease, without poverty, without conflict, without sadness, you know, a utopia. And the key enemy to all these things is inequality. Utopia is fundamentally a place where everyone will be perfectly equal, where men have attempted to create such a utopia. The creators of the utopia always end up far and away above the utopiates. The utopians rule the utopiates like masters or like zookeepers. The utopian is the idealistic reformer, and the utopiate is the fellow forced by the utopian to conform to his notion of equality. So much for equality. The point is, utopia is a fantasy that cannot be so long as man holds the dominion and refuses to yield it to Jesus Christ, the Son of God, the Creator. Man cannot storm Eden's gate, overcome the angel appointed there to guard the tree of life with the flaming two-edged sword, nor can man storm the gates of heaven, shaking his fist in the face of God and say, along with Satan, we shall set our throne above the stars of God, we shall be like the Most High, you know, or Satan's lie, we shall be as gods, and we will reverse the curse of sin. Yet it's impossible to build a tower to the skies, a ladder to invade heaven with an army of sinful men, set upon the task of unseating the Almighty from his throne, or even to banish him from his earth, and suppose that that he can, absent God, establish peace on earth, goodwill toward men. This only God can do, my friends. Therefore, the utopian pursues a fantasy, something that cannot materialize. And for that reason, it is all a lie. It is a world that can never be, not until Christ comes. Now, here's the catch. The progressives today believe that in order to transform the world as it is into the world as they think it should be, they must first dismantle the world as it is. They must break it down, destroy the intervening establishment. And here's the problem. These people are, in America, laboring to destroy the world as it is, to make way for a world that they can't deliver, okay? And excuse me, but Obama is not the Christ of God. So the point is that these progressives want to lead us out of a system that has a proven track record for providing the greatest distribution of wealth to the greatest number of people, the greatest measure of freedom ever enjoyed by any community of men on the planet, the greatest measure of liberty for all, and the greatest hope for justice this planet has ever known. And they want to do that in order to replace it with something that in their fantasy is better. They're going to destroy our liberties and make us slaves to a utopia which can only be constructed by forcibly imposing their idea of equality upon everyone else, but not on themselves. Oh no! In their utopia, they will be the utopians. You will be the utopiate. And like Lenin and like Stalin, they will shed the blood of millions in order to enforce their equality. So when you're following the unfolding of one scandal after another, cascading down upon Obamistan, thank God for the praying Christians and the salt and light of God, fearing patriots across the land, who are standing at first virtually alone against Obamistan. Others are beginning to wake up, but it's no thanks to progressives, let me tell you. Let's look at some of the consequences of attempting to pull this sort of thing on Americans. I want you to watch for two things as I go through this. First, the consequence of having someone like Obama in the White House, so drunk on power and insatiably thirsty for more. And then second, note the uniqueness of American liberty and how its unique features make it so resilient and so resistant to being overtaken by the likes of people like Obama, unlike France or Russia or China or Cuba. Susan Rice, remember her? She was second in command in the State Department when Obama and Hillary got together at 10 p.m. the night our ambassador was murdered by terrorists and hatched the plan to cover up the fact that terrorists did the deed by blaming the video. Well, Hillary and Obama, I believe, were complicit in the decision to send Susan Rice out with the riot made him do it Benghazi cover-up story. Over and over again, you saw her out there telling this lie to the American people, and now we know Obama, Hillary, and no doubt Susan Rice all knew it was a lie. Obama tried to reward Rice for lying for him and Hillary by giving her Hillary's vacated post as Secretary of State. Well, Republicans blocked that nomination, so now he has given her a post in government that requires no congressional oversight. It's a post that has enormous power to shape foreign policy. Interestingly, in effect, she's going to be supervising Kerry, who did get Hillary's job. So, in a way, you could say she's kind of getting promoted even above the job that was denied to her. A little revenge going on. He has appointed her to be National Security Advisor to the President. Now, do you think Cuba or China or old Soviet Union would allow this level of protest that has been stirred up by all of this? This much noise? I don't think so. How about the IRS scandal? IRS bureaucrats are accused of intimidating certain conservative groups into giving them the names of their donors. Oh, yeah. Now, this is on top of the current IRS scandal that's out front, the one involving using agents to intimidate groups that were forming to organize against Obama's reelection. You know, the discrimination suit. I don't know why we don't call it what it is. It's discrimination, you know, against the political opponents. It's political discrimination, anyway, against the federal government for singling out conservative groups for extra scrutiny as a way of intimidating them, hindering them, and keeping them on their heels while Obama was working to be reelected. Yeah, you know, when you think about how hard he worked to get reelected, it's no wonder he didn't have time to go to the Situation Room and guide that business in Benghazi. You know, he couldn't give Benghazi any attention until it became clear it might become something of an obstacle to him getting reelected. This man makes me sick. New scandal, my friends. Apparently, the IRS bullied some conservative tax-exempt organizations into giving up their donor lists to the IRS, and then the IRS turned around and used those to send agents after them, intimidating them, harassing them. It is an outrage, and it worked. Some of these groups reported a significant loss of revenue directly related to the IRS intimidation tactics. But do you suppose you would ever have heard about this in Cuba or in China or in the old Soviet Union? Well, yeah, if it happened to your immediate neighbor or relative, but then you'd be afraid to discuss it in the open. It surely wouldn't show up on the radio or TV or anything like that, but not in America. You see how this freedom thing really gets in the way of dictators, would-be dictators? It's sort of like that pesky Constitution, you know? It interferes with Obama types exacting whatever revenge they might want to get or give to those he supposedly protects. Increasingly, it looks like Obama's hand was in the IRS targeting of conservative groups during his election campaign. Get a load of this. Susan Anderson is an executive of Public Campaign. Now, that's a left-wing organization committed to, well, let's just say committed to Obama's reelection. Her husband is former IRS boss Douglas Shulman. Now, he's the guy who was in charge of the IRS when it was attacking anti-Obama voters. Mr. Shulman was cleared for 157 visits to the White House. And I understand he logged at least 11 visits. And I don't know how many of those was with the president directly. I think it might have been all 11 of them, with any number of more other meetings he might have made with lower-level staff. His predecessor visited the White House exactly once in his career. That's a 1,100% increase of activity. I wonder what they had to talk about. Maybe they were discussing how the IRS could illegally obtain the medical records. Perhaps they discussed ways to obtain donor lists from politically incorrect groups to intimidate them and harass them. Maybe they discussed ways and means to keep the Tea Party activists on their heels during the election cycle. Well, you know, he was the IRS department head, so no doubt they had some business to discuss, eh? But there is another frequent visitor to the White House from the IRS, one Sarah Hall Ingram, who was in charge of the tax-exempt organizations unit during the time the Tea Party groups were being targeted. She visited the White House 165 times. Or were those just, you know, scheduled visits that she didn't think? I'm going to pull that one, this one too. Most of these were with White House staff, but she did have, we know, 6 personal visits with the president. There is no reason at all for the president to be meeting with lower-level operatives, or even really with the IRS commissioner. Well, you know, anyway, Shulman has resigned, and Ms. Ingram has been promoted. Yeah, now she heads the department overseeing the IRS role in Obamacare. Don't you feel safer already? Welcome to Obamastan. But you ain't seen nothing yet. Wait till they finally get into full control of your health care. Politically motivated decisions about who will receive, what was that called, extra scrutiny from the IRS for a tax exemption. Well, that's one thing. But politically motivated decisions about who gets health care. Well, that's something else. Do you think our children are safe in the hands of these people? Already we're getting a taste of what it's going to be like when the government controls healthcare. Kathleen Sebelius, she's the one primarily responsible for the implementation of Obamacare. Recently, she refused to use her influence to put 10-year-old Sarah on top of the lung transplant candidate list. Now, 10-year-old Sarah qualifies to be placed on the top of the list because of her medical condition. However, the doctors involved in these life and death decisions rate the survival chances for little Sarah below the threshold of what they consider to be acceptable. So Sebelius is placed in the position of deciding this child's life or death. And the point is that government needs to be out of this altogether. I know many are making the argument that she has a responsibility to use her power to save this child, and I wish she would. And I think that's fine, and there is a point to be made with that, okay? But you're missing a bigger problem here. Since when do we put this kind of power into the hands of politicians appointed by the president? May God help us. We've seen what the IRS is doing. A president so calloused, he would virtually justify the actions of recent doctors who have been charged and convicted for murdering babies after they were born alive from a botched abortion. Don't roll your eyes. Hey, you are right over there. Yes, the third row from the back. You. Right, the one rolling you. Would you vote against the Born Alive Protection Act? Do you believe it's right to let a baby struggle in agony for its life and die on the cold steel table of an abortuary that survived an attempt to murder it in the womb? Would you vote against the Born Alive Protection Act? You, personally? Now, go ahead, cross your arms, get all puffed up. I know you're in a corner on this one. I understand that. This situation forces upon your mind the reality that less than 10 seconds before the baby breached the womb, it was legal to murder it. But upon breaching the womb, suddenly, it's an act of murder to kill it. Relax, my friend. Take a deep breath. I'm not trying to be mean. I want to help you. I know exactly what I'm saying here. He voted against the Born Alive Protection Act, just in case you don't know that. Remove for the moment the mounting evidence suggesting that Obama had his own hands in this. There is little, if any, question that the people involved were on a politically motivated quest to assist their boss, the president of the USA. And my point is that Kathleen Sebelius has no business making life and death decisions over any 10-year-old child in this country. You involve politics and health, and this is what you get. The government cannot make these decisions without either becoming personal or arbitrary. If it becomes personal, it must play favorites and will necessarily act in bias. If it remains aloof and arbitrary, it becomes a cold monster with the power of life and death in its hands and makes decisions far removed from the individual circumstances, decisions that must be made in the vacuum of cold abstraction, statistical research, impersonal and inhuman. Get government out of healthcare. Anyway, I've got to move toward a conclusion. In America, the truth does finally percolate to the surface. Sometimes it takes longer than at other times, but it does finally rise from the gutter into which the wicked attempt to kick it and beat it and keep it down. But so far in America, it has every time been able to finally struggle back to its feet like Rocky and go at it again. The question is, when the American people do finally hear and see the truth set before them, tall and strong, clear, without doubt, will Americans generally yield to the truth? Or will they turn their back on it and embrace the lie? It remains to be seen. I've lit the lamps in the church belfry arch. Now you call and let me know that you see that they are on. Call 1-888-770-8000. Go to our website, thebrainmassageshow.com. That's thebrainmassageshow.com. God bless you. God save America. And I'll see you in church.
For a complete brain massage experience, tune in Saturdays at 7:30 a.m.